on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
And the essence of what we keep coming back to here is there is this deeper calling that most people in the 21st century who are at least in some sense a seeker are finding the question of like, oh, where do I belong? Where's my people? Because everything's become a big stew pot. We have access to any information we want at any point in time. Therefore, very few humans actually have to embody knowledge anymore because we always have this digital tool that we can go to as a resource. Be like, my invitation is leave the digital tools, embody it, even if it means you slow down in your perceived evolution and relationship with the divine, with the she, with our relationship with the earth. Like, slow it down so that it actually becomes something that is instilled in your very body. It oozes out of your pores. And to me, that is really bowing in respect to that which has come before us, because it's saying, I'm willing to take the time, whatever the tradition might be, whatever aspect it claims to be adhered to, like, I am willing to take the time to actually embody that and know that as truth within.
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth. I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, I am joined by author, ecologist, and community activator, Jeremy Shavey, to discuss his book, Aisling, Discovering Keys in the Irish Celtic Mysteries. Jeremy discusses sacred sites and the land as a living expression of the divine, the she and Selkies, and the power of being open to a deeper calling. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Jeremy Shavey has been leading international sacred site retreats, socioeconomic service trips, and conservation-based eco-adventures for 10 years. He is an ecologist, botanist, tree keeper, and community activator who has worked around the world for the past 15 years with indigenous and at-risk communities. Jeremy is an avid outdoorsman and athlete, and he has 23 years of experience practicing and 15 years teaching Qigong and Daoyin meditation. In addition to these many talents, Jeremy is a carrier of the Light of Erin, or Solas Ga na Héireann in Irish, which is a Connacht branch of the Celtic Twilight, rekindled in the 19th century by W.B. Yeats, Lady Gregory, A.E. Russell, Edward Merton, and more. Through this, Jeremy helps sustain a bridge between the Celtic otherworld and the contemporary one. Jeremy has also been fully immersed in studies, fieldwork, and teaching of ecology, botany, herbology, shamanism, and Qigong, as well as Nordic, Sami, Hindu, and Mayan traditional ecological and mythological knowledge for over 21 years. He is also a certified herbalist. In 2017, Jeremy published his first book, Ports of Entry. He joins me today to discuss his latest publication, Aisling, Discovering Keys in the Irish Celtic Mysteries. Jeremy, welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Honored to be here.
Yes, well, thank you. I'm very much looking forward to this. We have a lot of mutual interest, I think. And I hope I did not slaughter the pronunciation too badly in the Irish there. And I have already talked to you about this, that I will do my best when they come up, but you are more than welcome to correct me. So I wanted to, you know, I mentioned that I just finished the book yesterday, and the way I've been thinking about it is that it is this beautifully written love letter to Ireland and the Irish. And I thought that we could begin. I wanted to ask you about your love of Ireland. What's the story with your relationship to the island?
Beautiful. That's a great way to start out. We share this interest of animism, spirituality, ecology, and for me, like, my background, both academically, but also just like what my soul has always thirsted for, is that deeper relationship with place. And so individuation years in my early 20s took me on the Red Road. It took me to the East. It took me all over, you know, as I sort of detangled myself from my environmental upbringing and allowed me to step forward into the world in a really strong way. And so the calling initially to Ireland was very much ancestral. Mm. So my mom's family all comes from up in Connacht, so the west, northwest of Ireland, from a little village called Tobercory, where I have spent a lot of my time in the years since. And so when I was ranging to my mid-20s and had an opportunity to go back to Ireland, I knew what I was doing was going home to mum's country and having an opportunity to dive deep. Having grown up in Cincinnati, Ohio, where all there is a very strong Irish influence, I mean, it's probably a third of the population there has at least 40 to 50% Irish ancestry. There's also a very strong German and Swiss heritage, which is where my surname comes from. So that's kind of the mind, but I think the heart of it's really important. You know, when I was in my late teens and I was traveling across the world, and especially in mostly North America on the festival circuits, and I was meeting some of my first spiritual mentors, and a lot of the work that they were doing with me, or when I would dance myself into a trance, I frequently found myself in this other world that had influences of, you know, Celtic iconography, if you will. But at that point in my life, like, that was neither here nor there. Like, you know, I would also see images that are iconic of, say, India or Hinduism, or even of my Catholic roots. All of those pieces were like woven together, like creating this basket of my soul, of my mind as it was emerging. So when I first got to Ireland, you'll probably recall from the book, there's a point where in there where my friend Shania de Barca takes me out to the Dingle Peninsula. She takes me out to the Cloakan, to the Beehive Huts, and does this journey work with me and asked me where I went. Well, she took me to a place that I had been seeing on and off at least 40, 50 times over the last 4 or 5 years prior to that. And so I shared that with her when I came out, and she said, well, I'll take you there tomorrow. I was like, wait, there's this place that I've been seeing inside that I just felt was part of like my sacred inner landscape. And now you're telling me it exists. And so, you know, part of the book, the Aisling, which means dream or vision in Irish, is our ability to surrender to a greater dream, even when it doesn't make sense. And so from 2003, when I had that experience with Sinead, and then she took me to Lough Gur, to this place I'd been visioning and dreaming for years. For the next 5 years, every autumn around Samhain or around Halloween time, I would start having new visions. And so I'd call her and she'd be like, oh, lad, that's that, come on over. So then I'd book to come over for like 2 weeks or a month. And so in a sense, it's more of this like deeper calling that Ireland or Eru or Aran or Kathleen Houlihan, the spirit of Ireland herself, that moves through all the various iterations of Irish consciousness throughout the millennia, called me home to serve, called me home to be another one of her stepping stones, as one of my grove ancestors or one of my spiritual ancestors through my mentor, line back to the Order of Celtic Mysteries, was Maud Gonne. And in her book, In Service of the Queen, she opens with this gorgeous quote about watching this goddess, this woman, this divine spirit, like bouncing across the bog as she was taking the train back to Dublin after being a part of a big pep rally, getting people excited about Irish emancipation. And when she was watching this woman, she was literally watching her jumping from stone to stone across the bogs up into the mountains, and she's just started weeping because she realized, for all of her self enamoration and glory and beauty, I mean, because she was a very well-known actress and was well endowed in the world, like, she realized in that moment that she was just a stepping stone for this ancient eternal spirit, Kathleen Houlihan, the spirit of Eru, the spirit of Aran, the spirit of Ireland. And so I was invited to become one of those stepping stones for an expression of the divine in this time. And so it became almost a matter of oh, it's not just I want to go to Ireland, or I want to go on pilgrimage in Ireland, or I want to go to see the Neolithic sites, or I want to go see modern sites. It was, you're coming, this is what you need to be doing. Get to work.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, that's it's an amazing story, especially with the visions in Loch Garr. That was the one that there was like the lake and then the four streams that were going into it, but yeah, Nothing coming out. And I remember you writing like, well, but that doesn't make sense. And then you see the final place. And it seems like it's a message that we all need to hold dear to our hearts, not just with Ireland, but wherever we are, to develop that connection to place. And I loved one of the things that you wrote let me see if I can find it here. The forests of the world call and I come running. And
yes.
So I was thinking about that in terms of Ireland, and I'm glad that you said that it was a calling for you. So let's talk a little bit more about the title before kind of going into anything else. So Aisling, you just said it refers to a dream or vision. What else?
Well, Aisling can also refer to a particular style of poetry. But the poetry itself, actually, I've got a book of 17th and 18th century poems here called Na Aislingi, which Aislingi is the plural for Aisling. And, you know, there's this era where a poet would establish in a relationship with a muse, so to speak, with an Aisling. So, I mean, that'd be another way to kind of think of it. It's like a spirit being, it could be like a guardian angel. It could be an emissary from the other world. It could be an ancestral spirit. Like, there's a lot of different angles that the academics would talk about in terms of the expressions. I believe it's all of it to some extent. But the Aisling frequently shows up, especially for men, as this like beautiful, ever young woman. So you could kind of think of like an elven woman from, say, like Tolkien, whose, of course, his works were very much inspired by the Celtic mythology and mythos. But also it could be a beautiful man that shows up. It could be a beautiful being that maybe is androgynous. Neither here nor there. What it is it's something that like draws this sense of longing and reverence and awe. But it's not just that it's this essence from the other world that's asking us to create, to be more in harmony with our relationship with nature and with spirit and the divine, but it's also an extension of that which is eternal, you know, and so in respect to an Aisling in Ireland, if you will, the Aisling is an extension of Ireland herself, or Aran, of the great mother, of the Mar Mullan, of the Mar Mahamar. This is my understanding of it. I believe that these Aislingi that show up for us in our lives are specific to us. So shows up, Jeremy, okay, you need to do this. You're going to do this dreaming. You'll call Sinead. She'll bring you to the place. Then you'll have these, you know, sort of this unlocking of memories. And at the same time, very practically, you have time that you get to spend with people in Ireland. You get to learn more about your heritage. Like, there's all these, you know, there's so many complex reasons behind the bonding, but the most important thing is like an Aisling is an invitation. It's a calling. Fiona MacLeod was sometimes considered to be an Aisling of William Sharp from up in the west of Scotland, and a lot of her works are very well known to Celtic archivists. And same thing with her, like she essentially became William Sharp's pen name, if you will. So Fiona MacLeod is William Sharp. But, you know, like my mentor, Steve L. Myers, would suggest that she actually was this other world being that inhabited the consciousness of and asked William Sharp to do specific things, write certain stories, write certain poems or runes or songs, etc., so that they would be passed on.
Okay. I definitely want to talk about the other world here in a little bit. But first, I want to try to be clear in terms of the Irish and the Celts. And please correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that when there's this, the tradition out of Ireland, that there was a pre-Celtic aspect to it as well. And Correct. It's this, because when we talk about the Celts, it's not just Ireland, you know, it's the British Isles and, you know, Scotland and, you know, I think it goes down even into throughout France and maybe some other places in Europe as well. But what was in Ireland is this unique merging of pre-Celtic and Celtic. Is that correct?
Yeah, and in the same regard, like, I think when we think of pan-Celtic, Celtic is cultural. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, there's a language tie. And yes, it spanned most of Northern Europe and France and Spain and all the way up into the Green Isles, etc. The cultures that existed before them, the great megalithic builders, were a culture entirely different. The Celts were a people of the forest. So most of our sacred places generally tended to gravitate towards groves, water, you know, a lot of the places in nature that I talk about in the books are these edge places. And yes, the ancient stone megaliths also continued to be sacred sites, similar to any spiritual or religious tradition. When you move into an area and there's already an area being revered as sacred, you continue to exonerate it. Unless you're an empire, then you destroy it and then build your own thing. But, you know, in sense, like, there is that place of being respectful to that which came before. So I hope that answers the question more fully. So yes, the Celtic is like this layer on top of an ancient Neolithic and megalithic mm-hmm. civilizations.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that interests me, and this is a question that drives a lot of my personal research, is this, I don't want to call it a renaissance, but it seems to me that there is a, I don't know the term I want to use. A lot of people now are kind of investigating what we would refer to as paganism and going back, looking at their Celtic heritage. And it, I know that a lot of traditions are being reassembled because so much had been lost with, you know, invasions and the conquest of Christianity and various colonization projects. But the sense that I was getting from your book is that a lot of the original traditions were actually preserved in Ireland, and that there doesn't have to be this kind of reinvention. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah. I mean, the thing is, just like, you know, I'm sure as a kid, maybe still as an adult, you've played the phone game, you know, where you like whispering to somebody's ear, right? I mean, the ancient oral tradition was about the memorization of specific rote, of specific bodies of knowledge. And yet within context of like doing a telling of a Shanachie, a lore keeper, like sharing with a community, they're probably going to draw from localized elements mm-hmm. for their telling. They're going to draw in and paint a character to sort of resemble, you know, people that are in the room in order that you've got people's buy-in and energy and current. So it is my belief that, you know, we've got, you know, several millennia of the phone game happening here. And then of course, you know, with the Christian immersion into Ireland as well as into the rest of the Northern Isles, that in some cases there were probably clashes. Mm. In many cases, from my understanding of the archives, is that there was absorption, that a lot of the ancient, you know, what we would have called the Druids, who then of course were embodied as Philes, poets, as bards, olives, they over time were parallel in sync with the early Christian church, and then with time were absorbed into the early Christian church, probably for practical reasons. Like if you're a lord of Connacht and you've got to feed me as a bishop and my brother Andrew as a druid both at the same time, instead of just feeding one chain, it becomes a bit of a burden with time, if you will. So I'm sure that a lot of things have been skewed with, like, for example, I just have been reading cinema of P.W. Joyce's Umramas, which are these stories of these ancient beings who basically just set sail and ran, like St. Brandon the Navigator is a great example of one. They just sailed all over the sea and just all these magical things that they run into. And as you get into the later centuries, the things that they're running into are less these amazing, like, fae islands of eternal youth and beauty. They're, you know, people in hell and burning, you know. It's just like, you know, so you start seeing this change of sort of a stronger, like, Benedictine sort of, like, the world is dark and behave yourself, you know. So bringing that back in a sense to, like, an Aisling, like, I believe, like, a lot of the 17th to 19th, early 20th century folk tales in Ireland that have a little bit of, like, a heavier, darker lilt when it comes to anything in nature is often because of just people were removed from and no longer had that opportunity to revere the nature. And so then the Aislinns then came as in as these sort of sinister characters. Hmm. Whereas, you know, having grown up freed from that, having grown up Catholic, but still freed from that, like, nature's, but, like, I grew up, nature was so revered by my family, so that it naturally dovetailed together that, oh, when the Aislinns come in, it's not like this skewed, twisted version of something. It's just, it can be in its pure and raw form. So again, like, to more directly answer your question and reiterate, I feel like the most important thing is of course, you're always going to have cultural clash, just like we have cultural clash right now between city and rural, like we have between people who have access to internet and resources and information and people who do not. Like, it's not that anybody's wrong. It's just that they're completely different worldviews and sometimes they clash. But my understanding is that while there may have been some of that, a lot of it was just an absorption and slow adaptation over time.
Yeah. Yeah. And it seems to me that a lot of that absorption is from the Irish perspective is something that can help us now. You know, I'm thinking in terms of, I think a really good example is we're recording this just a few days before Imbolc, which is associated with Brigid, who then becomes Saint Brigid. And it seems to me that since Brigid has been kept alive and in Ireland from your writings, it seems like she's still seen as a little bit of both, that there is this ancient Irish goddess of light and fire, but also Saint Brigid. But that allows a doorway into these older ways of viewing the world and the older ways of relating to nature.
Yes, definitely. I mean, Brigid oftentimes is considered the darling patron saint, or I would like to say the darling matron saint of Ireland. You know, of course, we've got Colm Kyll and St. Patrick as well. But, like, Brigid spans both of those worlds. And I think she's an excellent example of the living mythos inane in the landscape and the very culture of Ireland itself. I mean, just it is, but at the same time, like, most people in Ireland from their cultural Catholic roots aren't going to be like, oh yeah, I know all these things about the old gods or about the fairies. I mean, or the she, you know, like, I've had people when I've brought groups over to Ireland, you know, like, very American style, like, just bluntly, like, hey, do you still believe in fairies? But, like, I mean, people are still adhering to the pattern days and going to the holy wells and to the clody trees or the holy trees and to the caves and to the leaving offerings, making their prayers, you know, whether they're saying Catholic prayers or, you know, like, their paters and their maters and the credos or whatever it is that they're saying, you know, like, what we have is we don't have this, like, separation of church and state, of secular and religious, like we do in North America. Like, it is still wed together. It is part of our Irish cultural heritage that everything is wed together, that the land is a living expression of the divine. And the view lens that we look through just depends on what it is that we need to focus on.
Right. Yeah. And that comes across really clearly in the book, because so much of it is about these sort of sacred sites, be it mountains or, you know, lakes or caves, groves, that it's all there. And I think it's essential. But let's talk a little bit more about this sort of Irish Celtic mythology and worldview. And we're going to have to talk about the Fae. And I will be completely honest. I have been very resistant with some people who claim to, for example, it's a joke between a friend of mine that, you know, it's like, I'm not going to interview anyone who says that they are consorting with the Fairy King. But I am open to ideas of an other world, you know, the Summerlands and non-physical beings. There's just something about that Fairy King. But who are the Shi, and what is their role in the Irish mythology?
Well, first and foremost, we should just cut the communication right now, because frequently people jokingly call me the Fairy King. So you can't interview me anymore.
So I'm the one talking to the Fairy King. Oh, man.
Now, that's not something that I would take on personally. I don't need to be the Rena Shi, if you will. They've got plenty going on their own. But I think because of a lot of the larger community events that I help put on here in the Southern Appalachian Mountains, as well as over in Ireland. And plus, I have no problems completely relinquishing my abstract and scientific mind and allowing myself just to go into pure play and leprechaun. Yeah. Like, everybody says my eyes get greener when I'm in Ireland, like they're hazel here most of the time. Yeah. When I'm in Ireland, somehow they become just so much greener. And, you know, like a lot of people, that's the Shi coming through you. I mean, there's so much on the academic side that we could get into in the sense of the understanding, the promulgation relationship with the Shi. But I think, you know, the essence that's probably most important, which is what I'm really trying to convey in this book, is that when we follow a deeper inclination, when we follow a deeper intuition, follow a deeper calling, while it might not 100% sync up to what most people would adhere to as factual reality that you can fact check on Google, you know, like what that leads us to is to do greater things than we would be able to do on our own. You know, in a Christian context, we align ourselves with the divine, we align ourselves with God. You know, in a pagan context, we align ourselves with some aspect of the divine that comes from the ancient mythologies, and they help promulgate us forward by giving us little breadcrumbs that we can pick up along the way. There are loads of people who have spent a lot of time diving, like the work of Wentz back in the late 1900s, even again, my mentor, Stephen Myers, his work with the Chronicles of the Shi and like tracking things out in Scotland and the north of Ireland. Like, there are ways that we can look at it academically. But for me, I almost go, partly because my mom was a counselor, you know, in mental health, like almost coming in it slightly from a Freudian perspective. Don't put me in the Freudian box, please. But just to borrow a little bit from the archetypal understanding of relationships with the world, like, there are aspects of our mind that Velcro, adhere to certain expressions of truth in this world. And then we choose whether or not we're going to embolden that or make that entirely what is our embodiment. Like, I align with Zeus, or I align with Yahweh, or I align, you know, like, great. By choosing that name, you've already put yourself in this cultural context into a box, which then allows people to glue other cultural idioms to that. And there's a knowing, there can be a comfort in that, but there's also something that is really missed. So my feeling is that the fractals of sort of this Freudian psychology present themselves in ways that we can grab onto, that the divine will speak to us in the way that we need to be spoken to. So if you need to see an angel, you'll see an angel. If you need to feel the presence of an angel, maybe, okay, there's another thing I'm going to pause. Like, some people are going to be auditory. Some people are going to be visual. Some people are going to be intuitive and feeling. Some people are going to be completely logical. And they don't always mix. Like, something that we can talk about from a scientific and logical perspective, the rhetoric that we would use would be completely different vernacular than if we were coming at it, say, from a poet's perspective or some other angle. So my feeling is we, as individuals, we hone specific skills based on our environmental conditioning that we are raised with, and then by the influences that come into our world, and then we're going to be guided by, okay, maybe it's, you know, maybe some people feel really comfortable with trees and forests. Maybe some people, like, as soon as they get in nature, they're like, ah, you know, like, whatever it might be, like, give me the interface where I can learn the most and have the most exchange. And then sometimes, well, there's always going to be the energy of like, well, take this curveball in life. What are you going to do with it? What are you going to do? Like, I lost my daughter last year in November in 2022. And that was a massive curveball. And it just rearranged so many aspects of my life. And then it gave me an opportunity to like really dive in and like, what are the foundations of truly who, what formed me as a man in this 21st century? And then what do I have to give back from that? So my feeling on the she, again, I'm not going to pretend to represent mm-hmm. everyone in Ireland or everyone with Irish heritage in this way, but I think it's an important worldview, and it's a mature 21st century variant, is that the she are real. That this sense of other world that is parallel to ours, that is accessible through many different forms, whether it's intuition, chanting, music, healing arts, dancing, like, how do you get outside of the normal construct that you're fitted in, that you fit yourself into, or that the world has fit you into, and grant you the opportunity to open up synapses that were not opening before, so you can receive information, so you can see visions of things that maybe are ancestral memories, maybe are just predecessors of what are things to come. Maybe you're literally just traveling down, as you know, as we would use in modern science, traveling down a wormhole that actually connects us physically to another place in the geospatial universe, that then gives us an opportunity to learn something, to become soft again, and then to step back and see the world through the eyes of wonder and reverence and awe. Because my feeling is that's what we're all hungry for, is to find that sense of like the pure that sits inside of the chaos, to be able to push back the chaos just enough so that we can be in that deep peace, and then be in communion with the purest form of self in relationship with the divine.
Lovely. I like that a lot. And
I'm pretty sure that was one sentence too.
Yeah.
One run on.
That's okay. That's okay. Yeah. It's like the this interjection of the mystery in it to wake us up in our lives, it seems, to kind of shock us out of our everyday complacency. But they're also connected to the land, right? Deeply connected to the land. So one of the questions is, is Ireland their home, or can the she be found elsewhere?
Ooh, they're definitely elsewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, one of the first stories, so on my webpage on Enchanted Journeys, there's a sub page called the Celtic Scriptorium and Crypt. And there is a telling in there that I recorded, I think when I was like 23 or 24, that was a combination of Celtic and Cherokee stories. And so it's a story that didn't exist until, you know, that time when it was written, living deep in the heart of the Southern Appalachian Mountains, working way out in the national forest. It gave me the opportunity to like bleed together in my own being the expression of some of the stories of the land that I was living in and the realm of my blood. But it's interesting because many people of Celtic heritage, not just Irish heritage, but find that the she presents themselves all over the world. Some people don't see them anywhere in the world. Again, I mentioned my mentor Steve Myers, and he has said to me several times that he's never experienced them or the trees having consciousness like he has back in Scotland or Ireland. However, you know, like many, many people that I know have had direct experiences with them. And again, talking about the Order of Celtic Mysteries back in the turn of the previous century, like Ella Young was one of the strong proponents of that particular community and of the emancipation of the Irish. And eventually she, in the late 1920s, moved to the States. And in one of her last interviews in the 1950s that was recorded, she talks about hearing the Kewl She, the fairy music in the mountains in California, and that some days she would just wander off and follow that sort of unheard but heard music and just allow it to take her where it needed to. And then the revelations and the beauty that followed with those particular experiences. So yes, I believe that the She are all over the world. And, you know, of course, many cultures will have different names for the same species. West Africa, the Kuntumble, you know, like here in the mountains, the Cherokee refer to them as the Noonhir, the Umwaitsundi, and amongst some of the other names. Like, again, names that give us access to an expression of the mystery.
Yeah, if there's any place, I mean, I'm in Colorado, so I'm right by the, you know, I'm here in the Rockies, but if there was any place in the continental U.S. that I could imagine them being, it would be the Appalachian Mountains, because they're so old, so old.
And it's the same geology as the west of Ireland and the west of Scotland. Parts. Yeah.
So it would feel like home to them. And I think it's important that with the She, and when we talk about the Fae, you know, that these aren't, you know, they're not all just Tinkerbell. I think that is one of my resistances, or initial resistances. And who was it? Was it Sir Arthur Conan Doyle who had the photographs of the little girls with the fairies in the garden? And I'm like, no. But the She are very different. And there are so many different kinds of She. And I think that the ones that you talk about quite a bit are the, I'm trying to find it here. I've got all these pages of notes. The Elkies.
The Selkies.
Selkies, yes, Selkies. Sorry
gosh, the Selkies. The Selkies long ago wove my heart. So Sinead, the woman who did a lot of the connecting dreams and visions with physical places in Ireland, I'm pretty sure she's a Selkie. She's told me she's a Selkie, so I mean, that's helpful. But yeah, these beings that live in that liminal space between sea and shore, and that shapeshift, I think they're a good reminder to us of the challenge of shape-shifting to being in different environments and the importance of that. But, oh my gosh, they always just bring up this deep sense of just purity and innocence. When I was on the Isle of Skye 2 summers ago, my wife saw like 4 or 5 seals out on the Smith's Island right near Dunscarlach, which is on the west coast of the islands. And so we came back the next day and they were still out there, and I had all my scuba equipment with me, but I went out just as a skin dive and was able to swim out and around the island and through all of these structures and came around, and there was like 16 or 17 seals sitting on the rocks there. And I think there were maybe 3 males and the rest were females, and all of them except for 1 male and 2 females dove in the water and then swam around, surrounded me with the closest one, maybe 35, 40 feet. Most of them were more like 100 to 250 feet out, but all around me. And then when I would dive down, I could see them swimming around me, just like the gorgeousness of like how on the shore, how seemingly inadequate they are at doing anything. Yeah. Yet once they're in the water, how languidly beautiful their bodies are as they just slide through the water. But yeah, the Selkies, the seal people have stolen my heart and my innocence and frequently make my way back to their haunts.
Yeah. Is there a place in Ireland that you would say is your favorite, the one that pulls on you the most?
Yeah. My wife and I were married at Dunmorehead, which is the tip of the Dingle Peninsula. So it's just north of Sleighhead. And for years and years and years, it was a wonder, you know, actually it's still a wonderful place to go. They filmed a big portion of the recent Star Wars trilogy at Dunmorehead. And so it's become increasingly popular, but it has not really changed the essence of it very much at all. I mean, in this dune, in this fort, these red sandstone cliffs that thrust out into the sea, I feel like I'm standing on the edge of the world. Like for a moment, I can imagine simultaneously that the world is flat and that the water is just dropping off at the end, and that the world is so round, so enormous that I could just continue to sail through. And as we spoke to you before, like the Shi, like very much inspired the elven Valinor, the land of the eternal elves, like to be able to sail out in heart and mind and spirit across the sea and to find ourselves back in the Summerlands, back in Tir na n'Og, or back in Tir Fohen, or any of the lovely names we have for aspects of the Celtic otherworld. So yeah, Dunmorehead stole my heart long ago.
Do you think, the question I want to ask is, do you think that the Shi are calling to more people now?
Yes, definitely. I feel like that's why this book was, I mean, while I wrote this book, I was working full-time, managing a nonprofit, bootstrapping up environmental tech business, while simultaneously running a year-long Irish Celtic Mysteries immersion. So I was writing this book 11 o'clock at night until I could, you know, like the only thing that was driving me was the madness of my own Aisling, if you will, like that dream of just like, you need to do this. You need to do this now. The timing is crucial on the planet where we are right now. More and more people are being called back to their own ancestral lineage traditions. I mean, especially, you know, the explosion of the internet and the information and woke world, you know, like there's a lot of pushback against, you know, what we used to call cultural exchange, now being called cultural appropriation. You know, like people want to intrinsically know the essence of where they come from and where they belong. And especially for those of us who come from expat colonies, United States, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, you know, places where it's like, well, our ancestors lived there for thousands of years in autonomy and we're amazing sovereign people. And now we're here and now we're sitting on top of memories of another sovereign, other sovereign nations, our First Nations, our Native American people here. Like it can be confusing because the call from the land comes no matter what. It's just a matter of then finding, refining a filter or a lens to look through. So my hope is that this book will help be a segue to help invite more people to a clearer understanding. You know, I think one thing that's really important for listeners to understand is while this book does draw from the archives of our ancestry and provides an excellent backdrop, both historically, mythologically, like I'm not a reconstructionist. I'm not trying to recreate some pagan past that nobody really has a pure understanding of, because again, that was back in the oral tradition, and things as they became in the written tradition were during the early Christian era. Like I don't have a desire to be a part of reconstruction. What I have a desire to understand is where are we going in the now and in the future? I don't need that backwards look, because looking backwards has never fully done anything constructive for anyone in the long term. We have to understand where we are. What is the contemporary cultural stew pot of Ireland and other Celtic nations? You don't have shrines that thousands of people are walking to every day or every year in order to perform adorations, obeisances, or practice, you know, aesthetic practices. Those places are available. And I've spent many time in those places, sometimes days and nights, you know, not eating just so that I could really listen to the ancient ones. There is a place for that. And there's also an understanding of the beauty of what we're emerging toward is this bridge, sort of like Bridget, that spans both worlds. Because the beauty way doesn't need a name. The deep peace of the Dáin Síochán, as we would say in Irish, is the deep peace is beyond religion. The deep peace is something that is granted by the divine in a nameless form that is inviting us in the 21st century to go back to our ancestral roots, to have an understanding, and then to merge into the 21st century with the beauty of things that can be grown anew.
Yeah.
Or on the path of.
Yeah. And I really appreciated that about your book, because you are not prescribing, you know, well, here's a ritual, do this for this effect or anything like that, which is pretty common in a lot of books on, well, you know, I don't know if I should call it a book on paganism. It's a book on Ireland. But it seems to me that you are just following the voices that call. And I think that's a good model, because it seems like so many people, like you said, we want the tradition. And it seems that part of the challenge right now is to balance, you know, the traditions that have been lost, to kind of rediscover as much as we can, but to move forward on our own. And that we have to recognize that our own individual spiritual path is completely valid and legitimate, you know. And it makes me wonder, though, when I asked, you know, about the Shi, if they're, you know, a little bit more active right now, it seems to me that maybe part of that is, in the larger picture, nature, Gaia itself, remembering that we are part of it and that it is alive and has its own spirit.
Yes, very much so. I mean, I think probably one of the most important things in that regard is our Ashlins are inviting us to, through the breadcrumb trails that they leave us, through these little hints that come to us, are inviting us into a deeper harmonic relationship with nature and with one another, with fellowship of humanity. So both in nature as well as with one another. And that is the heart of this book and of this working, like the Ashling, the vision. What is the vision? What is the breadcrumb? Discovering keys. What are the keys? Here's a bunch of keys that unveiled themselves to me, both through teachings, mentors, archives, which again, in a lot of the ancient texts and translations are found in the bibliography of the book, like all of them providing various angles of access to the same thing, which is you belong here and there is something specific for your heritage, your bloodline, for your faith traditions that only can come alive through you. And if you fail, well, that sucks, because we've been really trying hard to get a hold of you for a really long time. And so they're going to keep trying. And sometimes, you know, like some people have like some really difficult things that happen in their personal experiences. You know, again, like I lost my daughter, like, whoosh, you know, like what? Like, when does a parent have to bury their own child except for times of war? Well, the war we're in right now in our country is a war of illicit, disgusting, evil drugs that are being flowed into our country that are undermining our youth and our culture. And backing up out of that, like keeping a little more sensitive to our conversation here, like, a moment like that where something horrible happens, we have a choice. Either let it destroy us, or like our Celtic ancestors, like Finn McCool, who would stand up and be like, all right, I'm sticking my thumb in my mouth. I got the vision. I'm going to do the thing. Like, let's go, lads. Let's go, folks. We're going to go do the thing. Like, are we going to stand up and do something bigger? And my invitation here, my understanding of the Ashlin is that your Ashlin is going to utilize the character traits, the skill sets that you have honed in order to help you do that work for you. And it's not just secularly like the little you, but it's the greater you, the I am that is in harmony with this world and the other, with timeless, with the divine.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, I think that this idea of place in regards to that is important. And, you know, as you've been talking, you know, there's a lot of, you know, we're divorced from our ancestral roots in many ways. And there is this desire to rediscover them and to go back to the lands. But what about where we are now?
Right.
How can the work you're doing help people who may be in Cincinnati or Denver or where have you? How do you think that they can be more open or open themselves to this invitation?
Great question. I think that has really been the heart of some of our deeper inquiry as it grew for the last 6 or 7 years, you know, the community that I share in these Irish traditions with, is we're here. Most of us are based in the greater Asheville area within at least a few hours of it. I mean, some people are from Chicago or New Orleans or Boston, etc. But, you know, like, what is being asked of us here? And I feel like there's two things that I want to touch into here. One is the beauty of the American mentality is we can do anything, which can be chaotic and reckless in some ways, but in other ways, it's created a lot of innovation and beauty in this world. So what does it mean to be of Celtic heritage here in North America, or in the Southern Hemisphere, or in Australia, or in New Zealand, et cetera, or even South America and Central America? And what does that mean? And one of the things that I have found along the way is that there is a way that we are as a people, a way that we embrace others that we cross paths with. There's a way that we embrace spirit that is unique to our culture. And it can get diffused, especially the more integrated it becomes with other world cultures as well. But the heart of it is, like, there's a special way that we engage with the world, with community, with people, with strangers, people that we invite into our home to share a cup of tea or a song, what have you. So, you know, it's like, on one side, it's like the importance of the promulgation of these ancient languages and traditions that is lost with an empirical language like English or Spanish or Portuguese, some massive language. And there's also a beauty to the mixing that occurs. I feel that probably the most important thing, most important message, which I spoke to earlier, that comes from these traditions is a recognition and understanding that we belong here, that we belong here on the earth, that our ancestors, you know, with the Book of Invasions, like, how many different settlements of Ireland happened, you know, in 4,000 years, what will be the Book of Invasions for North America? You know, you'll have the stories of the First Nations, and then you'll have the stories of the First Nations who moved because of colonization and redistributed the dynamics of where we're home and sacred place for the First Nations here. Then you've got, you know, the various waves of people that come in, each bringing their own essence. So to me, I feel like that's the most important thing, is that you belong here. You have a God-given right to be a part of a living relationship with nature and with the earth. And so, like, when I'm bringing people to Ireland, or when I gather people here in the mountains to do in-person work, like, or doing online programming, like, the essence is, like, here are seeds of inspiration. Here is how a lens that we can look into or through of our ancestral past, and understanding, apply it to your world, apply it to your place that you call home. Like, one of the things I frequently do with online classes is I invite people to first, via maps, figure out where the source of their water is. Some people, it's easy. They've got a spring right out back, or they've got a well. Some people, it might be a mountain reservoir just a couple of miles away, like for my house here in West Asheville. Some people, it might be pulling it up out of the Ohio River, you know, whatever it might be. Like, where is the source of the water that you're bathing yourself with, that you're drinking? And once you figure that out, go and visit it. Mm-hmm. Go and build a relationship with it, because that is your life. Water is our life. Mm-hmm. And so to be able to go to that source place, and of course, some places like reservoirs are fenced off, and so you have to actually ask permission, which I encourage. Like, you're building relationships with people. Like, call the management group that is the security and be like, I would like to come and just sit and watch the water. You don't have to say, I want to come and do a ceremony. I want to come make offerings, whatever it might be. Like, you know, whatever your thing is. Right. Like, maybe you're coming just to say some prayers, or just to literally look and be like, wow, this is what I bathe and drink from every day. Thank you. Thank you. And it builds a relationship inside, which then, of course, starts to tie us from this abstract digital universe into an actual 3D universe that is sustaining our body temples.
Yeah. No, I love that. I have a friend who does something like that in San Francisco, where he takes people to where the water comes from.
Nice.
And it's very important. And, you know, I spent the past 18 years in Southern California, and now I'm where we get our water. I'm back in Colorado. But yeah, I think that's so incredibly important to bring us home, you know, to bring us home. And it seems like that's something that is a running theme among a lot of people that I talk to in many ways. There's a couple of primary themes that keep coming up. One is remembering. We need to remember who we are. And I think of that in a number of different ways. And what's been going through my mind in this conversation is, I'm going to be just a little academic here. In 1967, there was this very influential paper, you are probably familiar with it, by a UCLA historian, Lynn White Jr., called The Roots of Our Ecological Crises. And he essentially argued that what was the root of it all was the Abrahamic traditions from Genesis, that we should have dominion over everything. And, you know, people from the religions, you know, are like, no, we have this idea of stewardship and whatnot. But the point I wanted to make is, he has this like a sentence in there that he says one of the greatest psychic wounds that ever happened was when Christianity took over these lands like Ireland and Scotland and various other places and severed the relationship with the divine beings that lived in nature. And so that was kind of what was going on in my mind behind the question of, well, are the she calling to us now? Because it seems like what's happening, and people may not be consciously aware of it, but that there is this attempt to heal that wound. You know, and I don't know that, you know, just a absolute rejection of the Christian past is what's necessary. And this is why I like what, you know, this model from Ireland, like with Bridget that we were talking about, where she steps into both worlds.
Yeah, one of the, like, this is tangential, but I think it helps to alliterate the point. Like, culturally in the West, you know, we're not used to, you know, women covering their heads and faces in public, so much so that some groups really feel like it, like they want to implement our Western will over. I mean, this comes across in many cases with cultural clash where, like, oh, all the Native American women, once they became Christian, oh, now they all have to wear tops. They can't show their breasts, because in Europe at that point, we had sexualized the breasts instead of just recognizing them for what they were, mammary glands for nurturing life. You know, like, cultural context and then implementation of will over always creates a destructive environment and creates a lot of chaos and then rends social structures from within, which I think likely a lot of that happened with the Christianization of our Celtic heritage. And at the same time, there were a lot of shadow elements of our ancestry that, I don't know about the Reconstructionists, if they're wanting to bring back human sacrifice, or if they're wanting to bring back, you know, like if somebody gets an injury, like they're no longer any good anymore because they're not whole of body. I mean, there's a lot of things in the ancient Brehon laws that in this day and age would just be utterly ridiculous to adhere to. And so, yeah, we cannot throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Right.
The evolution, I believe, what, again, the essence of what we keep coming back to here is, there is this deeper calling that most people in the 21st century who are at least in some sense a seeker are finding the question of, like, oh, where do I belong? Where's my people? Because everything's become a big stew pot. We have access to any information we want at any point in time. Therefore, very few humans actually have to embody knowledge anymore, because we always have this digital tool that we can go to as a resource. Be like, my invitation is, leave the digital tools, embody it, even if it means you slow down in your perceived evolution and relationship with the divine, with the she, with our relationship with the earth. Like, slow it down so that it actually becomes something that is instilled in your very body. It oozes out of your pores. And to me, that is really bowing in respect to that which has come before us, because it's saying, I'm willing to take the time whatever the tradition might be, whatever aspect it claims to be adhered to, like, I am willing to take the time to actually embody that and know that as truth within and exemplified through action, deed, and task.
Yeah. I agree with that 100%. I know that we are running out of time here. I want to be mindful and respectful of your time. But before we go, if you have a few minutes, I was wondering if maybe you could say a word about the retreats that you run in Ireland.
Sure. Yeah. So about 11 years ago, I started bringing groups over to Ireland to go visit the mostly Neolithic and early Iron Age sacred sites in Ireland, partly building that bridge of like giving people an opportunity to connect with places that still sing and there's opportunity for conversation and development, if you will, and then to bring seeds home and then to have that reflect our personal everyday relationship. While that still continues, it has become more of a literally retreat. Like, we typically house ourselves in one location, bring in Shaunakee lore keepers, traditional musicians, healers from around the whatever region that we're in, so that we can be in this really sweet container. So for the past couple of years, and including this coming July, July 11th to 18th, we host an annual retreat at the Temple House, which is in the south of County Sligo and is directly and indirectly connected with a lot of the ancient Irish Grail or Quarry Mysteries or Cauldron Mysteries. Funny enough, the Temple House is called the Temple House because the Templars had their furthest west establishment there at the Temple House. And for the last 400 plus years, lo and behold, the Percival family has been minding the estate and have been passing it on from generation to generation. So July 11th to 18th, we'll be at Temple House. We learn music, we do movement, we do Qigong practices, sometimes some yoga, just get people in their bodies. But we're also learning Irish Kyolic yogis, like chants and incantations. We learn songs, we get infused with the music, we go out to some of the sacred sites in the GR region. We get to hear amazing stories of place in respect to the ancient mythology. A wonderful, wonderful time. So yeah, so that's what we're doing at this point in time in Ireland, is hosting these week-long retreats. And I'm also putting together a 168-kilometer-long pilgrim's route from Rathcrohan, the sacred center of Connacht, the west of Ireland, out to Crowpatrick, the holiest mountain in Ireland, that we'll be walking this July as well. And by putting together, I mean, I'm stringing together, roughly based on the archives, a string of sacred sites on a walking pilgrimage that then ties into what's called the Tuatha Dé Fhadraic, is the sacred way, traditional walking pilgrimage there. So, yeah.
Okay. Sounds wonderful. Yeah. And it seems like you have a lot to choose from, because at one point in the book, you noted, I think, that there were over 138,000 known sacred sites in Ireland.
Phenomenal. Phenomenal. I mean, even just this extension of the Tuatha Dé is already threading together some, I think, 340 sacred sites. And that's just within like a 200 or 300 foot wide swath, you know, winding through Connacht. Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, so just to be clear, and on that context, like, the sacred sites, those are including like all the archaeological sites too, that some academics might not consider sacred sites, but others might, you know, so like a rat or a ring fort might not be considered a sacred site archaeologically, but for the last hundreds of years, when most of them have become covered with forest, they've become shelters for biology, and they've also become shelters for the she, if you will.
Wonderful. Well, I know that there's a lot more that we could talk about. We could talk about the Grail. We could talk about the cauldron. I was actually making a connection with some other readings from the ancient Greek with the crater, I think they call it. Yeah. And so there's a lot more that can be talked about. But what I'll say is, people should pick up a copy of your book. It will be out and available by the time this is released. So let me ask you just a couple of final questions. One is, what do you have coming up? You talked about the retreat in June, I think it was. July, excuse me. So what else do you have coming up?
Yeah, so every year our grove helps put on a fairly large regional Beltinus celebration, so May Day, if you will. So May 3rd or 4th, I can't remember what Saturday is, sort of the crown of that particular event. So we host that here in the Southern Appalachian Mountains. So that's more than open. People are welcome to come. People do come from all over the country, and people do come home from Ireland for it. The other piece, I think, in respect to the book, et cetera, that I think is really important is every year, starting at Samhain, the Grove welcomes new incubants, people who are interested in diving deeper. You know, like, the book is a great purveyor of information and essence, but then to actually like build that with community. So we have 4-day long immersions for all of the cross quarters. And then we usually spend a week or two in Ireland together, depending on what the Grove has been brewing up for the year as the essential places that are calling to us. That's mostly in person. We do some of that online as well through monthly Zooms. Also in winters, starting next winter, again, there'll be a like short series of like week long, like 4 to 6 week long courses where we meet each week, once a week in an evening for a couple hours to go deeper into things as well. I think the other thing that's probably important to put on the table as well is, you know, so I can be found at enchantedjourneys.com. Okay. Thank Enchanted you. Journeys, Enchanted is spelled with an I. And partly I did that because for me, singing is very much a way of conveying. So enchanting instead of enchanted. So Enchanted Journeys. So like we are navigating our own ships by singing, by chanting. So on there is several places that people can dive into further information. We spoke a little bit earlier about the Celtic scriptorium and crypt. So that's a great place for accessing resources and activities and things that we are doing as a community. And then finally, another way would be to get on the Enchanted Journeys website and just sign up on the contact list. And we do mostly in the winters, like a monthly email. In the summers, it comes out about every 6 or 8 weeks. And that tells people about like upcoming Imbolc event or upcoming Beltane or something that we're doing for midwinter or some service project that we're working on together as a community, whether it's here or in South America or in Ireland or something like that. But yeah, it's sort of the clearinghouse and way that we're able to communicate with the world.
Okay. And that was enchantedjourneys.com.
Correct. Okay. Yeah. Enchanted with an I.
Yeah. I'll put a link for that in the show notes in the video description, as well as links for your book. Okay. And again, I highly encourage people to pick up a copy. I thought it was, like I said, it's a beautifully written love letter, is how I was looking at it. And so I enjoyed it very much. So Jeremy, thank you so much for your time. I thoroughly enjoyed the discussion. And like I said, there were other areas that we could have gone, but I want to be mindful of your time. But thank you. I really appreciate it.
You betcha. Thank you as well.
And that's a wrap on episode 122 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you're part of my YouTube audience. Now, you know what's coming up next. All the usual. Sign up for my Patreon. Share this with friends, family, coworkers, and on social media. Subscribe to the podcast or follow it on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. You know the grind. But here's the thing. All of that is really important. Putting this podcast together takes quite a bit of time and effort. Right now, it is a labor of love. I'm in the process of making changes to improve the podcast and the YouTube channel. It's slow going, but your support will help me speed up the process and ensure that I can continue with the podcast and hopefully offer much more content than what I provide now. As I always like to say, I'm here on the front range doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality, and ecology, psychedelics, and consciousness, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's relationship to a sacred earth. So if you feel moved by the Rebel Spirit, and you know I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to, or watching, Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be in peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your rebel spirit.